Welcome to the National Federation of the Blind's 2025 Senior Retreat, a time for empowerment, connection and growth. A special thanks to Janie Degenshain, Zoom administrator, and her team for a seamless retreat. Your dedication makes this event possible. Thank you for joining us on this journey.
Hello, everyone. We are getting ready for our last
Louis Henry.
And I'm asking everybody to please mute yourself so we can get started here for our 11 o'clock hour. We will have a door prize at some point. Nobody knows when, including me. I don't know. But in the meantime, we are going to turn it over to Duncan Larson for Cane Travel.
Thank you, Judy. Good morning, everybody. This will be our last day of Cane Travel, and we are going to try to leave extra time at the end for questions because we've just had a lot of really wonderful questions. So we want you to be able to ask, and it can be about anything that we've talked about through the week. But along with me is Martin Becerra Miranda. He is a certified orientation and mobility instructor and teaches cane travel at the Colorado Center for the Blind. It was really my wonderful pleasure to work with Martin for a number of years. So welcome, Martin.
Thank you very much, Duncan. Happy to be here.
So we are going to talk about outdoor travel. We talked about outdoor travel yesterday, but we're going to talk about a little more advanced, including crossings at lighted intersections, buses, paratransit. One thing we were in the middle of answering yesterday, and we ran out of time, was that people asked about how to cross or how to travel around roundabouts. So I was wondering if you wanted to take that on, Martin, and talk about that a little bit.
Sure, yeah, I can do that. First of all, thank you guys again for having me. It's a pleasure to be here with you guys. So as far as navigating a roundabout, I think one of the biggest challenges that we might have is going to be maintaining our orientation relevant to the intersection. Typically we come up to a traditional intersection and we're at a 90 degree corner where we can quickly identify which one is our parallel traffic, which one is our perpendicular traffic, and identify a cycle or a surge pattern. What happens with roundabouts is that as you're approaching a roundabout, things sound very different and things look very different, right? You're going to have, it's going to sound like cars not necessarily coming to a full stop unless they're beginning to enter the roundabout. And once they do, it's going to sound like they're going at an angle, not necessarily directly parallel or directly perpendicular to us because they're in that circular layout of the roundabout. And so the first thing that you'll find is there's going to be a crossing as you're approaching. There's going to be a crossing. Let's say your street is on the left as you're approaching the roundabout. There's going to be a crossing on your left side to go across the street you were walking along, so across your parallel street. And if you continue, the next crossing you're going to find is going to be a ways away. Typically, at a traditional corner, they're fairly close to each other. But in this instance, because you have to have the space for the cars to merge into the roundabout, there's going to be a bit of a distance and the sidewalk is going to begin to curve away from your parallel street. Eventually, you'll find that next crossing and that'll be to cross the what we would consider the perpendicular street as it's leading into the roundabout. Once you find those crossings, one of the great things, in my opinion, about roundabouts is that they're going to be directional crossings, directional low spots, right? Where very, very few times are you going to have to worry or concern yourself too much with your alignment being correct. Oftentimes at other intersections, you'll have a low spot or a wheelchair ramp directly at the corner where it's sending you diagonally into the intersection. So we don't experience that very often at roundabout crossings. And so, once you get yourself lined up, whether it be with the traffic or using curb alignment, right? This is one of those few times where it's okay to do that once you've identified that it's a directional crossing and you assess that there is no traffic going into the roundabout. So picturing the roundabout on our left and the perpendicular street in front of us, making sure there's no traffic going into the roundabout, so from our right to our left, and then listening for cars on our left in the roundabout and trying to determine the speed, right? Kind of the noise that the vehicle is making, that tells us a lot about their speed and kind of what their intention is. So if it's maintaining a consistent speed and consistent sound, it's going to continue in the roundabout. However, if it's beginning to exit the roundabout, what we will hear is them slowing down a little bit, right? So if we can hear that, then that helps out a lot. If we're not able to distinguish that, then ideally what we would wait for is what we call an all quiet, all clear. So that's going to depend on the amount of traffic found at different roundabouts, right? Some roundabouts are don't have as much traffic as others. So that would be an instance where we would use that all quiet, all clear to let us know when it's safe to cross. one last thing about roundabouts is that when you're making those crossings, a lot of the times these roundabouts, the streets that feed into the roundabouts are going to have medians. So you want to, as you're crossing, think about how long it should take you to cross any number of lanes, right? If you start your crossing and all of a sudden you've hit another wheelchair ramp or you've hit the low spot, but it seems like you've only started that crossing just a couple of seconds ago, odds are that you're on a median. And so in that instance, right, what I like to do is I like to continue to slow my pace down just a tiny little bit and make sure, again, that there's no traffic feeding into or out of the roundabout, and then continue and finish the second half of my crossing. So that would be my approach. Duncan, I don't know if that is kind of what you were looking for, if there's anything I need to clarify or add.
I think that was really thorough. The interesting thing about roundabouts is that I believe that roundabouts have been developed here in this country to slow traffic down a little bit in certain situations. When I was in England a number of years ago, the roundabouts there are to make the traffic go a lot faster. So it was a little crazy to be around that. But I can't remember who asked that question, but if it was you and you want any more clarification, please let us know now or when we break for questions in a little bit. Okay. Well, Mark, why don't, if you want to talk about crossing at lighted intersections and things to think about when you do that.
This is
sure.
Judy.
Oh yeah, go ahead.
Can I say one thing about roundabouts or what?
Sure.
I think?
Absolutely.
Yeah, go ahead, Judy.
I think that I would be totally confused. And so I have two suggestions to people. One is, if you know you're going to have to cross one, if there's someone who can go with you to describe the thing, that might be helpful. If you're never going to have to do it again, just ask someone to go across with you. And if you if you have to get used to it, then you want more of a description that maybe people can give you.
So, yeah. And remember that we're talking about a more advanced travel situation. And I don't want anybody on this call to think, well, if I can't cross a roundabout, I can't get out and travel. You absolutely can. And a lot of people travel all the time without ever really running into a roundabout. So.
Yeah, they aren't very popular in a good part of the country. I know, I think on the East Coast, and I've heard recently that in Georgia and the Atlanta metro area, they're starting to and place them more and more around the city there.
Yeah, here, this is Winford. We have some in one of the neighborhoods. They're fairly small, and then we have one really big one that I've actually not checked out. But one of the other things, which I'm sure is going to be covered with the crossing the traffic lights, is if you're going to encounter one of the roundabouts, also don't be in a hurry to cross. Analyze so that you can really get a good idea what the traffic flow is doing in order to get across.
Good.
Yeah, I think that's a super important point. And I kind of, I was going to somewhat lead into that. So if we have students, I'm kind of just speaking from a perspective of here at the center, we have students where they've encountered an intersection, whether it's a roundabout or a complex intersection, that they just don't feel comfortable with crossing. We also talk about self-determination, right? The last thing you want to do is force yourself to make a crossing just because you think that's what you need to do. So there's other ways to get through that. And of course, one of the options would be to ask for information or assistance. Another one would be to, hey, walk down the block and maybe there's an intersection, you know, a block away that's a lot easier than this one. It takes you out of your way a little bit, but in the focus of safety, you know, we have to keep that in mind first.
Right. Good point. Okay. So, if you want to proceed about crossing at lighted intersections, how to approach, what to listen for, etc.
Yeah, absolutely. So, as Winford was saying, right? When we come up to any intersection, we want to pay attention and just assess what's going on, analyze the traffic to determine a handful of things about the intersection. So we want to identify what type of control is at this intersection. Is it a stoplight or is it a traffic light, right? And the way that we're going to tell that is based on the traffic pattern and the traffic surge. So if I walk up to an intersection and I hear cars, let's say on my left where my parallel street is at, sitting there, I hear a handful of them. And all of a sudden I hear like this cross traffic, perpendicular traffic moving, right? And again, it's not just one vehicle. It's not just two vehicles. It's a surge of vehicles. That is a really good indicator that more than likely you are at an intersection that has a traffic light, right? And if you analyze long enough, you should be able to pick up on the pattern of how long each street has the green light for, right? Which would then help us identify more times than not which of the two streets at this intersection has priority, right? So that way we can determine, depending on what street we're looking to cross, do we want to go find a pedestrian crossing button? A lot of the times people find those buttons just anytime they're making any crossing. And as I tell my students, that's, again, something that you have to decide for yourself. If you feel like you've identified the intersection cycle and you feel like there's enough time with your parallel traffic moving for you to get across that street, then by all means. But if you're still unsure or if you feel like you just need a little bit more time, then go ahead and find that button, right? As we're listening to the traffic flowing through the intersection, another thing that we're identifying is the layout of the intersection, right? So we have a traditional, a lot of times people call it a plus sign intersection, like a four-way intersection, right? There's two streets that are feeding into an intersection. Both streets are approaching the intersection from two separate directions. We have what's called a T intersection. So you would have a cross street, a perpendicular street, and then a let's say a parallel street if you're walking alongside it, and one of those two streets ends at the intersection, right? So it doesn't continue through the intersection and pick up on the other side. It just makes that T into the intersection. And of course, this is a reference to a Prince capital T, right? Where you have the stem being one street and then the horizontal part of the T being the other street. We also have...
oh, shit, some random text message. Okay.
We also have, as we were talking about, roundabouts, so I won't go too much into that. And then along with the type of intersections, we want to, as we're listening to the traffic, try and identify if, as the streets are feeding into the intersection, are they feeding in at a 90-degree angle or very close to that? Or are they coming in at such an angle where it makes the crossing and makes the traffic sound a little bit different than it would typically? And again, we do all of this by listening to the traffic. And the way that I like to explain it is, if you hear a car idling, try and plot that, right? Try and almost make like you're drawing, let's say, like a line graph or something, right? And you put one point where that car is starting, and then track it, make another point a couple of seconds, and then make one last point at the last time that you hear that car, right? And if you draw a line from point A to point B to point C, that's going to kind of give you a mental image of what that lane is doing, right? And if you do that for two, three, four cars, and they all follow that same pattern, then now we can confirm that that is indeed what that street is doing at that intersection, right? Is it going directly through? Is it angling? And of course, the reason why this is important is because if we're dealing with an angled crossing, we want to make sure we're accounting for that during our crossing, right? Making sure that we're not walking in a perfectly straight line if the crosswalk itself is angled. And of course, once we're in the crossing, we want to continue to check in with that traffic, both with the parallel traffic and with the idling traffic if we have some, and find that medium point, I should say, between the two types of traffic. Let's see, what else do we have here? So back to the pedestrian buttons, right? So the buttons themselves do a couple of things, right? So what will happen when you hit a button is that the next time that your parallel cycle, your parallel traffic goes through, meaning the traffic that you're crossing with, you'll get a little bit more time to complete that crossing. The other thing that it does is that it turns on the walk signal, right? And so for a lot of us, that might seem and sound insignificant because, hey, perhaps we can't see that walk signal, so how is that going to affect me? If you think about a driver coming up to an intersection, and maybe they're coming from an angle where they don't see people at a corner or starting to go into the crosswalk, they might see that walk signal, which in turn would prompt them to be more cautious as they're going through the intersection, right? So it's kind of a secondary effect that it has on us. And then we also have what are called, I've heard them called two ways. So I've heard them called audible pedestrian signals and accessible pedestrian signals. So we'll just go with accessible pedestrian signals because what that does or what that tells us is that there's more than one way that button is accessible. And so with some buttons, you'll have a tactile arrow pointing in the direction that button is intended for you to cross, right? And plenty of times that tactile arrow is the button itself too. So you'll push on that and it'll audibly tell us to wait. And if for some of them, if you push and hold, it'll tell you the street name that it's intending for you to cross. And then when it's time for us to cross, it'll tell us, you know, walk sign for, let's say, Main Street is now on. And if we keep our hand on it, if we need this additional accommodation, a lot of these buttons will also vibrate to let us know that the walk sign is on and that we're okay to cross now. I also always want to clarify that just because the button is telling us it's safe to cross doesn't mean we just take off and beeline it to the other side of the street. Of course, we want to confirm with the traffic that it's doing what we want it to do. There's no traffic turning into our crosswalk. There's a surge going, and that'll give us that confirmation that we're okay to initiate our crossing.
And I want to add something about locating the pole for crosswalks. If you want to use the crosswalk signal so you have a little more time to cross, use your cane. Probably that pole is not going to be right next to where you are when you come up to the intersection. Oftentimes it's a little bit off, a little ways away, maybe 5 feet or something like that. I like to have students use a wide arc to find it.
Mm-hmm.
That'll save a lot of time. Just use a wide arc with your cane to locate that.
Yeah, and specifically what I like to do is, like you said, Duncan, most of the times that button is not going to be immediately by the low spot, by the wheelchair ramp. It will be every once in a while, but more times than not, it's not going to be. So my first go-to is, all right, we found the low spot. We found the wheelchair ramp. Let's do a 180, turn away from the intersection, and check up into that grassy area or that landscaped area, right? That's a lot of the times that's where you're going to first find it. And if you don't find it there, the other thing that I always like to convey is, as you're searching, make sure that you're searching in a pattern so that you're not just jumping from left to right, back and forth, right? Check, as you turn around, kind of break down the area into three different zones. Check the left zone, check the middle zone, and then check the right zone, right? That way you're not checking over and over in the same space.
Mm-hmm.
Good. Yeah. I guess the other thing, with lighted intersection crossings, well, there's a couple of other things, but one of them is going to be your alignment, right? So as I mentioned earlier, some intersection corners will have a diagonal low spot, a diagonal wheelchair ramp, meaning that the wheelchair ramp, if you were to line yourself up with the slope of it, is just sending you directly into the middle of the intersection.
Mm-hmm.
I have not confirmed this, but my assumption is that they do that for financial reasons. It's probably a lot cheaper to put one low spot in than it is to put two low spots, two wheelchair ramps. Sometimes that might also have to do with the available space on the sidewalk or in that vicinity. But if you're at a new intersection, one of the first things we want to do if we're intending to cross at an intersection is identify, is the low spot, is the wheelchair ramp that I'm on, is it a diagonal crossing? Is it a diagonal low spot, I should say? Or is it a directional low spot, right? Because that's going to determine a lot what tools, what techniques we use for alignment. If it's a diagonal low spot, then we're going to focus heavily on the traffic, meaning identifying our parallel traffic, make sure that it's staying in a straight line alongside our shoulder, right? And when we hear that cross traffic, again, making sure that it's staying in a straight line going across our chest, so from left shoulder to right shoulder. Usually when you're standing at a corner and you're getting yourself aligned, if you hear the traffic louder on one side or the other, more times than not, the reason for that is because you have that ear closer to the traffic. So I always like to tell students, does it sound louder on your left or on your right? And when you identify that, if you bring your opposite shoulder forward, that's one way to kind of even it out and ensure that that traffic is going across your chest evenly. Now, if you've explored and you found that a corner has directional low spots, meaning there's two low spots, one for each street crossing, obviously we still want to focus on that traffic and identifying parallel and perpendicular, but this is one of those instances where we can use the slope and the curbs of the low spot to assist with our alignment. It's kind of very, very important, right? Identifying the type of low spot that you're initiating your crossing from. And then the last thing that I'll say about this is, as you're going into your crossing, consider the type of contact that you want to be using with your cane. And this varies for everybody, so I'm not going to tell you that one way works best over another. For some students who have veering issues, we found that two-point touch really impacts that in a positive way, right? For other students who maybe have neuropathy or have more challenges identifying Texture and elevation changes, we found that constant contact works better. So it really depends on your particular situation. But if you're, let's say you've been at a crossing several times and you've completed that crossing, and maybe it's not going exactly perfect or the way that you'd like, and you feel comfortable attempting a different technique, contact technique there, I think that would be a good time to do so.
Okay, and also I want to remind you what some things we've talked about when you're getting ready to cross. If you have a sun cue, have that be another piece of information along with the sound of the traffic, walking parallel with the traffic, keeping that wherever you feel the sun in the same place on your body. So I think that can be really helpful.
Can I add a couple of other things, Duncan?
Yeah, well, I also want to remind people that you can walk up to an intersection and there's so much, just because you don't see it doesn't mean that you can't tell many, many, many things about the intersection. You can tell about how, especially as you get more experience, about how many lanes is this crossing going to be? Is it a one-way or a two-way? You know, what is the traffic doing?
Yeah, so, absolutely.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. This is just the last couple of things I was going to add. During the crossing, many times we'll feel the crowning of the street, right, where we have the high point in the middle of the road for that drainage on either side into the gutters. So oftentimes, if we're able to distinguish that, that's a tool that we can use to make sure we're going directly across the street and not sloping alongside it. And the other thing is, if you're crossing and let's say you're using a two-point touch technique, as you're getting close to the other corner, you might be able to hear the sound of your cane tap echoing off of a building or off of the curb many times, kind of letting you know that you're approaching the end of your crossing.
Okay.
And this is Winford.
Yeah, go ahead.
And along with that crossing, one of the things that some of the students, when they're crossing, once they get almost across the street, one of the things they, if they're doing two-point touch or even constant contact, sometimes they may start slowing down and change from two-touch to start doing constant contact. One of the things I tell my students is try and keep your rhythm, whatever it is, all the way across, because when you change from two-point to constant contact, then you tend to slow down, you tend to change your gait, and then that's when you veer and stuff. Yeah. Other things that I explain with my students, the APS is when you push those buttons, or they have the beeping, or so like the we have a slow beep for north-south, for east-west here, fast cadence beep for north and south. But then the other ones, they talk. And so one thing you want to be aware of is, because many students will do this, the walk sign is on the cross North Lamar, and immediately they want to start walking. So you don't want to do that. You want to, again, listen and assess whether, because if it's talking and the car's making a right turn, you're paying more attention to the voice rather than the traffic. So you want to still be conscious of listening to the traffic. And I have, when it counts down about 20, from 26 to or so to 25 or 4 is when I tell them to go ahead and start walking, but give the driver eye contact so they know that you know that they're there.
Okay. Thank you. Mm-hmm. I think we're going to, is there anything else, Martin, you wanted to add about crossing lighted intersections?
No, I think that was it for this section.
Thank you. So I think we just want to take a few minutes to talk about using buses and paratransit.
Okay. Yeah, and I'll definitely try and be a bit more brief with this one since we
No,
want to
that's
lose some
okay.
time.
That's okay. We just want to make sure we have a lot of time for questions. So.
Yeah, absolutely. Public transportation, right? So fixed route buses, light rails, trains, flex rides, just all different types of modes of transportation depending on the city or the environment that you're in. So one of the things that's important and relevant would be planning your trip, right? So when you're in an environment like a training center, a lot of what we do is we work on breaking down an address system, identifying the major streets in the city, kind of just getting a layout of the city, and then giving our students a destination based on either an address or some kind of general directions. I don't think that's very typical, right? Once we're out, kind of outside of the training center environment. So a lot of the times, what we want to do is we want to make sure that we're going ahead and planning a trip ahead of time. So that can look very different depending on your particular situation. So that could be using a GPS-based transit app, maybe like a Google Maps, Apple Maps. There's different ones. There's some that are specifically developed for blind people. You have like Blind Square, Voice Vista. You just have an array of them. You can also use the websites or the customer service call center for your local transit authority. So many of these authorities will have a website, and on that website, they'll have a trip planning section where you can enter your starting point, your destination, and the time you want to either depart or arrive, and it'll break down the route for you. I'll say my approach is always to start off with one of the apps and kind of get a general overview of the route, right? See what I can understand of the route myself, and then call customer service, and that way I can confirm with them if the route that they're giving me is similar to the one that I found on my own. And a big benefit to calling the customer service call line is that you have a representative on the other side who's looking at the map. So you can ask very specific questions, right? Not only about the transit portion of the route, but also about the walking portion of it. Get cardinal directions, maybe get landmarks, get street, I'm sorry, names of streets along the way, and just kind of confirming that. One kind of new feature that we've found is really helpful is that a lot of iPhones, you can now record a phone call while you're placing that phone call. And for some people, it's a bit much to take notes of a route while you're on the phone, getting that route information. So you can record the call, and then your phone will provide you a transcript of the phone call to where now you have access to it just by, reading that note. As far as kind of continuing with public transportation, you want to make sure that you're aware of the schedules of the buses or trains that you're using most frequently. A lot of them will run kind of on a set time, so either on the hour or on the half hour. And if you're in a super populated part of town, some of these trains or buses may even run every 15 minutes. So just kind of identifying that. Also identifying, let's say if you're looking for a bus stop, what is that going to look like, right? Is it going to be a shelter, right? Like a structure? Is it just going to be a pole? Is it going to be a bench? Is there going to be a trash can by the pole with the sign? Is there anything distinct about that sign to identify that it's a bus stop, right? And so kind of knowing these things ahead of time and knowing where they're most likely going to be located relative to an intersection or relative to the block, that's also very helpful. For example, here in the Denver metro area, the bus stop signs, it varies, right? Sometimes there's benches, sometimes there's a structure. Most of the times it's just the pole with the sign on it. And the way that we distinguish it is that the sign is a flag style sign where it only sticks out on one side of the pole, right? And the other thing is that most of these bus stops are relatively close to an intersection. They're probably within 100 feet or so of an intersection. So that kind of gives us a better idea of where to look and what to look for. And then kind of once you've gotten through that process, right, we talk about boarding the bus and exiting the bus safely. So, right, just standing a couple of feet away from the curb, making sure that you're giving the bus driver enough room to pull up to the curb. If you need them to lower the ramp for any mobility challenges, then of course communicate that with them. And then as you're boarding, kind of knowing whether you want to sit in that ADA seating, which is typically at the front of the bus, right? And those seats usually are facing into the center of the bus, or going a little bit further back where you have the seats that are facing forward, facing the front of the bus. And then the other thing would be requesting a stop. So knowing, does the bus system or train system that you're riding, right, is it automatically gonna announce every stop? Does it only announce at transfer points? Does it only announce at major streets, right? Knowing that ahead of time, and communicating with the driver where you want to get off if you're uncertain, but still making sure that you're taking on that responsibility and not just handing it over to the driver, because they can be very busy and dealing with other passengers and may forget your stop. So you want to make sure you have a backup plan in those situations.
Yeah, we've all seen drivers forget to call a stop. So
yeah,
be in control, be aware.
Some of these the things that we're talking about. When I first moved here to Austin, and they explained to me, when you look for the bus stop poles, it's a square pole, and it has like a rectangular sign on it. So, and then some of them have a bench and a trash can. Some of them don't. It's just the pole. And if you find a pole that happens to be on a wide sidewalk that feels like a platform, if you hit it with your cane and you put your hand on it, if it has a lot of holes in it, you're not at a bus stop. And believe me, I stood next to many holy poles, not realizing that it was not a bus stop. Bus kept going past me. I'm like, what is going on? So
yeah, you want to, though, this could vary from city to city. So
and one thing to encourage
you to find out what is true for your own neighborhood.
And something that's been very helpful lately has been the development of a lot of these applications on our smartphones, right? You have Seeing AI or Be My Eyes, or I don't know, there's an array of them where you can use your phone's camera and take a picture of the sign and have it tell you what the sign says, right? So that would be something like just to confirm, right? Or if you're in a new environment, trying to identify exactly what you need to be looking for.
Okay. Go ahead.
Sorry, Duncan. So yeah, just quickly touching on trains and then we'll move on to paratransit. If you're using trains, one of the first things that you want to do is obviously make sure you're using the cane technique that's best for you to identify elevation and texture changes. A lot of the times, depending on the system that you're traveling on, you will have either heavy rail, which is where the rail itself is set down about 4 to 5 feet, right, beneath a street level, if you will, or you might have an elevated platform. But in any matter, then the other alternative would be you have a light rail where the tracks are maybe only a foot or so beneath the platform level. So obviously we want to identify this just so that we're being safe around those drop off, those edges of the platform. The commonality is that at all of the stations that I've been to throughout the country, train and light rail, there's always going to be a tactile marker to let us know when we're approaching a track, right? Some places it's truncated domes, right? They're plastic and very high contrast colors, so you can identify it either visually or tactically. Other places that may be a little different. It may, you know, maybe it's the contrast is a bit more faint and the material is not as tactically different. So you might have a little bit more of a challenge with that. But again, that's why I want to make sure you're using cane technique that's going to keep you safe and help you identify those changes as quickly as possible. And then once we've identified, is it a heavy rail or a light rail? That's going to tell us once we're starting to board the train, right? Once the train has pulled up, we've identified that this is the train that we want. We've identified where the door is located. As we're boarding, if it's a heavy rail, that means more times than not that you're going to have level boarding, meaning as you're stepping onto the train, there's not going to be any stairs to go up. You're stepping onto the same level where the seats are going to be located. However, if you're going to be boarding a light rail, and you don't have an elevated platform, then more times than not, you're going to have to go up some steps to get to where the seats are located. And most of these systems are also going to have the announcements. You want to identify for trains and buses, but trains especially, if these trains are your typical train lines that stop at every station. Is it an express train that maybe only stops, you know, a couple of stations, or is it a limited that maybe only runs during a certain part of the day? So identifying all of these things is going to be really helpful for navigating in the train station environments and on the train itself. And then unless there's any questions about trains or if we want to add anything, we can talk about paratransit.
Yeah, let's go ahead and talk about paratransit.
So paratransit is a little bit different than our fixed route services, right? Paratransit is more door-to-door service as opposed to curb-to-curb, like fixed route services, right? So with paratransit, there is an eligibility process, and a lot of the times there's an assessment or an evaluation that you have to go through to determine whether you qualify for these services or not. And, you know, the benefit of using a paratransit service is, as I mentioned, it's door-to-door service, right? You get that assistance. Let's say you're going from your home to an appointment. Many a times you will get a phone call the night before confirming your appointment. Then you'll get a phone call. It varies on the different transit companies, but maybe you'll get a phone call when your ride is 20 or 15 minutes out, right? And then if you've requested it, a lot of the times the driver will come and meet you at your door, right? Help you get to the paratransit bus or vehicle. And then on the other end, help you get to the front door of your destination. So with paratransit, one thing that is very different is that you have to call ahead or use, let's say, their website to schedule a trip. Some of the paratransit companies allow you to schedule a recurring trip. Let's say you go to work or you go to an appointment on a regular basis, then you can set that up so that you don't have to call every single time or every single day. Something that's very different as well is that there are pickup windows where once the driver has arrived to your destination, let's say you did not request door-to-door service, they're just in your driveway or in the parking lot waiting for you. They give you a window. You want to make sure we're very, very aware of what that window is, right? Because we don't want them to leave and then we get dinged for not showing up because unfortunately that does happen. And kind of along this idea of window pickup times, let's say you scheduled a ride for 9:15 a.m. Many of the services will have a window that they can pick you up in. So it could be anywhere from 9 to 9:30, let's say like a half hour window. And then, of course, when we're using paratransit, we're not the only ones in the vehicle. So this is one of I guess I would say the cons of using paratransit is if you're in a rush to get somewhere, you cannot dictate that you be the first one dropped off just because you're in a hurry to get somewhere. It basically goes off of, the driver and not the driver, but the system that they're using that maps out the best route for everybody. So you might get picked up at 9 and you have to be in that vehicle for a good amount of time before you get to your destination, let's say at 10:30 or 11, where any other service, whether that's fixed route or rideshare services, might have gotten you there in a lot shorter time. So pros and cons of using paratransit, but definitely a tool that can really expand our independence if using fixed route services is not going to work for us, or it's not ideal based on the location of where we live. So just, be aware that that is an option.
Okay. Thank you, Martin. And, one thing I didn't put on the schedule is to talk about Ubers or Lyft. Is there anything you want to say briefly about that, about using those services?
Sure. A couple of things. So rideshare services, there are some transit companies across the country who are contracting with Uber and Lyft and other rideshare services to kind of take on some of the responsibilities of paratransit. Here in Denver, it's called Access on Demand. And there are some benefits, right? You get a certain number of rides. It covers a certain amount of the cost of your ride. And either you have to pay an initial, like a base fee, and then cover whatever amount goes over the limit, whatever the transit company is paying for. So there's that. If you're using these rideshare services on your own, the pro benefit of it would be that you don't have to call ahead and schedule. If you're able to, you can just pick up your phone. You can either use the application, and I know Lyft for sure. I don't know about Uber, but I know Lyft has a phone call that you can call to schedule a ride. So maybe you're not the most tech savvy, you can still use those services. And then kind of having a consideration of, the driver's time, making sure that you're out waiting where you're supposed to be, because they're not going to come to your door and help you get to their car most of the time. And kind of just keeping that in mind, but it is another added tool to our independence.
This is Judy.
Yeah, Judy.
Well, I just want to say that I don't know what it's like everywhere, because in Minneapolis, it is Uber that has the phone you can call, not Lyft.
Oh, so, that's interesting.
Yeah. So, I think Uber does it almost all over the country, maybe not totally, I don't know. And you establish an account with them, and you can call them, and they'll tell you when they call you. And I don't know how well it works on a landline.
I don't know
either. They want to send you texts telling them that your ride is there.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Here in Austin, what they do is, so if you have a landline, you can have them set it up to email you, to text you, or to give you a phone call. That's how they've got it set up. So I get a text 30 minutes before, and then about 5 minutes before my window. You can use the website to set your ride up. They've also got a app that you can use to set your ride, although that's getting ready to change. They're getting ready to do some really weird and bizarre stuff, so I don't know. and it's really convenient to make the ride. So you have to make, if I need to go somewhere tomorrow, I have to make my ride before 5 o'clock today. Mm-hmm. And then they're I've been really pretty lucky. Like if I've forgotten to set a ride to go home from the gym, I can call them like an hour to 30 to
Are you talking about Lyft or Uber?
Oh, I'm sorry. I was talking about the Metro Access, but I got off track there. Sorry about that.
Why don't we, sorry to interrupt, Winfred, but I think we want to open it up to questions.
That's wonderful. I don't see any hands right this moment, but if you want the floor, remember to say your name and wait to be recognized.
My name is Judith. I do have my hand up, and does Stuart. So I don't know if
you didn't see those.
Yeah, I'll lower it now.
No, that's fine.
I live in Denver, and I use the AccessoRide, a taxi cab, Metro cab. Mm-hmm. But I was not aware you could use Lyft or Uber. I do not have a smartphone. I have a landline.
Right.
So if there's a Lyft phone number you can call without having a smartphone, that would be great. I do not text.
Yeah, I think your first go-to would be to call AccessoRide and speak with somebody there about getting you signed up for the Access On Demand service.
I am signed up. I use the Metro cab through them.
That's right.
I don't use the Lyft because I was told by them that you have to have a smartphone. So if you knew something differently, then that's what I was asking about.
You do need a smartphone. You can have a somewhat smartphone, like the blind shell phone. That you can do that, but you can't do it on a landline.
Okay, thank you.
I'll just say that I think if the calling options to set up a ride are available, then perhaps you can maybe create an account with Uber and Lyft online, like on a computer, on a desktop or a laptop, and then get the information for ordering rides through a landline via a phone call.
Maybe.
It
might be hard getting home. You can get there because you have your email there.
Yeah.
That's a good point, Judy.
Okay. Stuart Prost?
Go ahead, Stuart.
A couple of comments. First of all, at some point, if you could go over hitting diagonal curb cuts, because they do occur in our area, Norfolk, Virginia. But in terms of a couple of things, first of all, our experience with light rail has been that it's the opposite. The light rail is the one that's ground level because it's low, and the commuter rail or heavy rail seems to be the one with steps and will be on a platform. And that's the same way with Amtrak, for example, a lot of places. And the other thing I was going to say too is that our paratransit in this area is curb to curb. It is not door to door, and so you've got to know in each city how they're supposed to operate, because they make it very clear you got to be waiting outside for them and this and that and the other thing.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Those are all things to check out in your own city. I know we talked a little bit about the diagonal curb cuts, but if you want to go over that again, Martin.
Sure. Was there like a specific question that you had about it, or?
Well, I think just in general, how do you align yourself so you're going straight across? Yeah, because the problem is if you follow the curb cut, you're right. You go right into the middle of the intersection.
Right. So when finding those diagonal crossings, or diagonal low spots, and you've identified that it's a diagonal curb cut, checking out how wide the curb cut is, seeing how rounded it is, right? If it starts to sweep away from your parallel street even before you make it up to the low spot, that is usually an indicator that you have a dedicated turn lane, making that curb cut way more rounded. And so the reason why that's important is because once you've identified that, what you can do is you try and find the curb on the side of the low spot for the street that you're intending to cross, right? Use that kind of as a general point of alignment. Make sure that it's going off of your shoulder and perpendicular to your body. And then kind of step back over without changing your alignment. Just step back over towards the low spot and confirm again with the traffic that it's doing what you want it to do. and go ahead and attempt that crossing.
Okay, thank you.
This is Shelley.
Yeah, Shelley.
Hi. Couple of thoughts I had. Now I'm listening to this curb cut thing. What I would say simply about that is you stand up on the, you know where the curb cut is to your right. I'll put the street on my right side. You stand up on that curb cut. You'd be on the left side of the curb cut, right at the point where if you took your foot slid it to the right, you'd be at the curb cut, and you stand on that upper side and cross. So you're by the curb cut, but you're not right in the curb cut is the way I've aligned myself to not angle out in the middle of the street. I was also going to mention that if people live in a more rural area, we were talking about a lot of city things. You can also, as kind of a mid-city, 50,000 to 100,000 or whatever, like around here in Columbia, South Carolina, there's not much for buses, city buses. And you can figure out through going to the bus company or maybe a reader, somebody that could help you if you haven't lived there a long time, especially, and figure out which are the main north-south streets, main east-west streets. And sometimes you can plot out your understanding of the city by learning what the major arterial type streets are, and then kind of go neighborhood by neighborhood. You know, like if you're kind of staying in your neighborhood to do walking or something like that, or whether you're maybe traveling to the downtown area. But you can learn a town even without all this traffic and that, just by having an understanding of kind of your cardinal directions, like we said, and then your main arterial streets and some of the lesser ones that might be important ones that have libraries or whatever you're going to on it, and that kind of thing.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. What I would add to that as well is looking into maybe the different community services of the place where you live, right?
Yeah.
A lot of places, community centers or resource centers, you can get a lot of information, and some of them even provide free transportation. So looking into that as well.
Correct. Well, I've discovered the Area Office on Aging, and it's kind of called a little bit something different, like we're in Lexington County. So you get the Lexington County it's got the word recreation in it, but it's basically the Area Office on Aging, and those kinds of places can give seniors especially, and anybody in general, but information on various transportation.
That's a good, really good resource.
And some of them can take you to medical appointments only, some can do shopping and medical, some cost a little bit of a fee, some are completely free. You'll find out a lot of information that way.
This is Judith.
Patty has a raised hand.
Okay.
Patty, you have the floor.
Yeah, go ahead, Patty.
My question is, with the accessible pedestrian signal, then when the walk sign comes on, is that actually when the all the turning traffic is done and you can safely cross? Or I know what I mean to say. I have trouble with it, you know, with the turning arrow that get first dibs or whatever the heck it is.
We've got just a minute or two left here.
So Patty, I think you're talking about a left turn arrow. Usually when that signal comes on, that left turn portion of the traffic has already gone through, and then your signal goes on. If you're unsure, go ahead and hit the button and just listen to the intersection go through its cycle one or two times and confirm that way.
Don't forget about right turn on red. People can, after your light changes, they can turn right in front of you.
Right.
There's another hand raised. Judith, have the floor.
Yeah, I know. I came in a little late. Could you just give me a brief description of what a curb cut is?
That's
pretty elementary.
No, that's okay. So it's kind of used interchangeably. So no fault at all. Some people call it a low spot. A wheelchair ramp is essentially the location along the street, usually at a corner, sometimes in the middle of the block, where pedestrians are able to get across the street. So it's essentially the wheelchair ramp to enter into a crosswalk.
Okay. Got it. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. We're going to have to stop for this hour.
I want to thank Martin. Thank you so much for your presentation. It was very thorough. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you all so much. Hopefully I didn't talk too much. But I do. This is, I think, the second year that I've been asked to present, and it is one of my favorite things to do. So hopefully you guys will have me back.
Yep, we will definitely be calling on you next year if we... You know, I'm assuming we'll probably have a retreat. So anyway, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for spending your time with us today. We appreciate your participation. For more information, contact President Glenn Crosby at nfbseniors@gmail.com or call 443-681-9345. We look forward to connecting with you again soon.